Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 230. It's Monday, October 2nd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, let's get right to it with an Ohio story. This from the Dayton Daily News. Narcan and naloxone boxes being installed at Ohio highway rest stops. Naloxone kits known as Nalox boxes will be installed at highway rest stops in order to expand access to medication that can reverse the symptoms of an opioid overdose. Naloxone, with one of the name brands being known as Narcan, is medication that rapidly reverses the effects of opioid overdose and is a standard treatment for opioid overdose, according to the FDA. Naloxone can restore consciousness and breathing to someone experiencing an overdose, but it is harmless if it is given to a person not experiencing an opioid overdose. More than 130 boxes with naloxone are being installed at 65 rest areas across the state. Last year, unintentional drug overdoses in Ohio resulted in almost 5,000 deaths, according to the Ohio Department of Health. That is nearly four times greater than the fatalities caused by motor vehicle crashes over the same period. In 2014, Project Dawn distributed almost 3,000 naloxone kits statewide, which resulted in almost 200 known overdose reversals. In 2022, the number of kits distributed increased to over 200,000 and about 18,000 overdose reversals that were known, according to the governor's office. All right, Ohio, way to make another small step to help pen in the opioid overdose crisis. Okay, well, next up, since we're in the era where gun deaths have taken over as the leading cause of death for kids, we have this story. Give us some, shine some light on why that might be. This from the 19th. Suicide rates of teenage boys are skyrocketing because of firearm access. Experts on adolescent suicide say too often guns and stigma around masculinity and mental health lead to deadly outcomes. Suicide rates were 3.2 times higher for teenage boys than teen girls between 2018 and 2020, with guns increasingly playing an outsized role. Boys and young men represent 80% of all youth suicide deaths and 90% of those who die by suicide using a firearm. Few people know that the majority of gun deaths in this country are actually suicide, said Nina Vinnick, the founder and executive director of Project Unloaded, an organization that works with teens and adolescents to make data-backed decisions to reduce the risk of being hurt by gun violence. When most people think about gun violence, they tend to think about interpersonal gun violence, which is certainly important, but really overlooks the crisis that we are facing with firearm suicide. Suicide is the second leading cause of death among people ages 15 to 24 in the United States, and suicide rates for 15 to 19-year-olds have jumped by 29% in the past 10 years. Vink noted that the suicide rate, already at a 20-year high, is rising the most quickly among young people of color. And in terms of how youths are dying, young men of color are seeing firearm suicide rates increase exponentially by triple digits. This is having a particularly devastating impact on young people of color, and I think this has really been overlooked in the data. Presently, the firearm suicide rate is highest with Native American, Alaskan Native young men, and black men. But Asian Pacific Islanders, Latinx, and black young men constitute the fastest growing suicide rates of any racial and ethnic groups in the United States. The reality, Vink said, is rooted in the fact that young people of color often have a harder time gaining access to mental health resources and treatment when they are struggling. Stereotypes about race, geography, and gun violence can also hinder their ability to get help. in areas of the country where crime is prevalent, that's what people think about when they think about young kids of color and gun violence, Fink said. They aren't thinking about the mental health challenges young people of color are facing, so they don't think about risks of suicide. But for young people of color, young men of color, this issue is in fact top of mind. Vinnick cites research conducted by Project Unloaded that has found that young people of color in particular, when compared to their white peers, cite the intersection of mental health and firearm suicide as an issue that they are very concerned about. This is all the more true for young men of color who live in areas with high rates of community violence, often in urban centers, who cite feeling pressured to have a gun themselves for their own safety and protection. These same young men, however, often also say that they understand that more guns are not making their communities safer, and in fact that more guns are making their communities less safe. Urban areas are not the only parts of the country feeling the weight of firearm suicide among young men. In rural areas across the United States, suicide rates are increasing, especially among young men. Kurt Michael, the clinical director of the Jed Foundation and an expert on adolescent suicidology and youth mental health in rural communities, Michael has spent significant periods of his career working throughout the South and the West in rural communities where suicide rates tend to be disproportionately higher. He said that often in working with families who learn that their son might be suicidal, adults are often not aware of the fact that having a firearm in the home poses a direct threat to their child. That conversation can make for a critical moment to discuss safe storage. When you explain it that way, especially from the point of being respectful of their customs, whether that be hunting or shooting sports, their acceptability of different storage practices is often pretty high. Vinnick echoed this sentiment, stressing that the majority of young people who are killing themselves with guns are accessing those guns in their own homes. More and more people are bringing guns into their homes, and when they do that, that increases the risk of suicide for members of that family threefold. For young people, the risk increases fourfold. Michael pointed out that firearm suicides have an over 90% mortality rate. Young men tend to pick firearms as their first choice of method when they attempt suicide, which is why their rates are so much higher for that demographic. Method selection explains the difference, but exactly why males tend to pick up firearms as their first choice is not well understood. For context, Michael explains that typically people who are older, white, and male are more likely to attempt suicide using fatal means, most often guns. Historically, younger individuals have tended to choose less lethal means and thus do not die of suicide attempts at the same rate as older Americans. But with increased access to guns, especially after the pandemic, when gun sales soared and feelings of loneliness and isolation increased, firearms are now entering the equation when it comes to suicide and young men in a way they have not historically. Michael also pointed up an uptick in suicide attempts amongst younger male teens utilizing long guns and rifles because prohibitions for getting handguns are often more restrictive. According to federal regulation, adults have to be 21 to buy a handgun, but only 18 to buy a shotgun or a long gun. In other words, it's once again a question of access, Michael said. Michael pointed to traditional cisgender masculinity as a factor in the rising suicide rates among teenage boys and young men. If you are a person that's either been raised to believe that seeking help for mental health ailments is a sign of weakness, you might also be a person at risk for suicide. Because of the way many boys are socialized and because of cultural norms that exist around the idea of masculinity, stigma associated with needing, let alone receiving help, might explain why young men are being so disproportionately impacted by suicide, especially suicide involving firearms. This stigma can be even more compounded in rural communities, he said, where fear of even having your car recognized outside of a provider's office might be enough to stop someone from seeking the help they want and need. For some individuals, these are really legitimate reasons. Michael pointed to research showing that rural teens perceive themselves as having at least twice the level of access to firearms than their urban counterparts. Understanding just how widespread the problem of suicide deaths are among teen boys in America is thus also about understanding not just the realities of rural living, but the realities of gun access. If you look at a sample of states with high rates of gun ownership and then compare them with rates with relatively low rates of gun ownership and look at total suicide rates across those groups, the higher number of suicides in the high gun owning states seems to be associated with gun suicides and not other methods. This makes owner responsibility all the more important. Safe storage, Michael said, is an essential component when talking about addressing suicide generally, and especially the trends being seen with young men. There's definitely an access problem, being that it's too easy to get access to a gun. Regardless of demographics, anyone who has access to a gun, that's something that immediately puts them in harm's way. Michael himself is a lifelong hunter, participant in shooting sports, and a gun owner. The way I store my firearms is very specific, trying to create multiple prevention techniques to prevent access. He recommends all gun owners to do the same, emphasizing that even firearms procured for protection should have barriers, like a biometric safe. It's never about confiscation, he said. It's always about safe storage. What this means, Michael said, is that suicidologists like himself are also learning that educationally and clinically, training for healthcare and mental health care providers is absolutely necessary to ensure that mental health professionals, doctors, and educators know how to talk about firearms respectfully, while also explaining both the risks they can pose. An analogy he often returns to, he said, is the way pediatricians encourage parents to child-proof their homes when their children are toddlers, to keep them from accessing chemicals kept in the kitchen cabinets, for instance. Anyone who is in proximity to a loaded firearm or a firearm that is unlocked and has ammunition close by is more at suicide risk, Michael said. Storing guns in a way that prevents young people from getting to them can change that. The other thing that can help change the current reality of the firearm suicide rates among young men is changing the more stereotypical gender norms. If you think about traditional gender stereotypes of being a stoic male, this might contribute to less acceptable attitudes around being vulnerable, talking about what's bothering you in ways the stereotypically might be more acceptable if you are not male. The male identity is currently tied to stereotypes about being strong and resilient and being able to do something on your own. Having a different attitude about help-seeking might change that. And I'll end on the Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you or a loved one are in crisis, you can call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800-273-TALK. That's 1-800-273-TALK. Or you can contact the Crisis Text Line by texting TALK, T-A-L-K, to 74174. Okay, well, next up, I have a little story here on a little different take on the upcoming flu season. This from the Center for Infectious Disease and Research and Policy. The CDC launches Wild to Mild Flu Vaccine Campaign. In an effort to rebrand and right-size expectations on the seasonal influenza vaccine, the CDC late last week launched a new campaign called Wild to Mild. Decorated with pictures of ferocious wild animals paired against mild house pets, the campaign portrays the flu shot as a way to lessen severity of illness and not necessarily preventing the virus. The intent of the Wild to Mild campaign is to reset public expectations around what a flu vaccine can do in the event that it does not entirely prevent illness, the CDC said. Participants found this information useful and even motivational in consumer testing. CDC has expanded its vaccine effectiveness work to include looking at how well flu vaccine works at preventing serious outcomes, like emergency department visits and hospitalizations, the agency added. This work has contributed to a strong and growing body of evidence that flu vaccination reduces the risk of serious outcomes in people who get vaccinated but still get sick. So this is something we've learned with COVID, too, that, you know, doesn't necessarily prevent infection, but it can prevent the severity all the way from the most severe things or even moving from a moderate to a mild or a mild to an asymptomatic. So it's not just avoiding infection, but it's avoiding the severity that can cause problems from just missing a day of work to ending up in the hospital. Okay, well, next up, got a story on the value of nutrition and food as medicine. This from Medical Express. New report shows food as medicine interventions would save U.S. lives and billions of dollars. Incorporating targeted food and nutrition strategies into healthcare on a national level will improve health and quality of life, reduce work for hospitals, and cut healthcare costs, according to experts studying food as medicine efforts. The health and economic benefits of this approach are detailed in a report out from researchers at the Food as Medicine Institute at the School of Nutrition Science and Policy at Tufts University. The True Cost of Food, Food as Medicine case study quantifies the potential health and economic benefits of food as medicine efforts, which refer to food-based nutrition interventions integrated into the healthcare system to treat or prevent chronic diet-related disease. This approach has shown promise in recent years for not just boosting nutrition and improving health outcomes, but also for reducing food insecurity and increasing health equity. According to research data presented in a report, national implementation of medically tailored meals in Medicare, Medicaid, and private insurance for patients with both a diet-related condition and limited ability to perform activities of daily living could avert approximately 1.6 million hospitalizations and result in an estimated net savings of $13.6 billion in healthcare costs in the first year alone, after accounting for implementation costs. Further, the report shows that national implementation of produce prescription programs for patients with both diabetes and food insecurity could avert almost 300,000 cardiovascular events and add 260,000 quality-adjusted life years. That is a measure of how well a treatment lengthens or improves patients' lives. While being highly cost-effective from a health perspective, this is based on an incremental cost-effectiveness ratio of $18,000 per quality-adjusted life year, and cost savings from a societal perspective, given the fact that it actually saves money. Today's report further demonstrates how food is medicine interventions like medically tailored meals and produce prescriptions, combined with nutrition education for doctors and insurance coverage for nutrition counseling provided by registered dietitians, could make a real difference in the 10,000 weekly U.S. deaths and $1.1 trillion in annual healthcare spending and lost productivity due to poor diets, says the report's senior author, Darius Mozafarian, a cardiologist and director of the Food is Medicine Institute. The true costs of our food system and environmental impact of how food is produced, the working conditions of the people who grow it, and the impacts of our health, healthcare spending, and health equity are too often left off of the price tag, said Devin Clatell, Vice President of Food Initiative at the Rockefeller Foundation. So this is just dealing with nutrition interventions within the healthcare system. Of course, there's a lot of prevention that can happen outside of that. And of course, the true costs of our food systems do include the environmental impact, the whole food system, you know, people that grow it and the working conditions and that type of thing. So you'll hear more about that on this Just for the Health of It. Okay, well, let's stick to some nutrition and diet stories, but let's switch gears a little bit and go worldwide. This is from Food Politics, Rising Prevalence of Obesity in Developing Countries. The International Fund for Agricultural Development released a report, Overweight and Obesity in Low and Middle Income Countries and Rural Development of Food Systems, along with a literature review. The report finds obesity rates across developing countries to be approaching levels found in high-income countries. And I just want to point out that nutritionists understand malnutrition, where you're starving to death because you're not getting enough calories or protein, you know, is a form of malnutrition. But actually, obesity is another form of malnutrition, kind of two ends as far as how it affects body weight. But this study attributes the rise in these developing countries to four different things. First, food prices. The price gap between healthy foods, expensive foods, and unhealthy foods, inexpensive, is greater in developing countries than in rich developed countries. Diet. Sugar-sweetened beverage consumption is on the rise in developing countries, and the global sales of highly processed foods rose from 67.7 kilograms per capita in 2005 to almost 77 kilograms in 2017. Third factor, culture. In some developing countries, childhood fatness is associated with health and wealth, and consumption of unhealthy food carries prestige. Fourth factor, gender. Women are more likely to be overweight or obese than men in nearly all developing countries. One strength of the studies is consideration of the need for interventions across the entire food system. The study results show that food system-related interventions are not overweight or obesity-specific. Instead, they tap into the wider field of making diets more healthy and nutritious and emerge as necessary strategies to set the scene for creating non-obesogenic food supply chains. That's food supplies that cause obesity. The identified intervention strategies cut across different food system domains. There were production strategies for improved dietary diversity, strategies for processing, which involved food package labeling or price mechanisms, strategies for changing the food environment, and strategies to address consumer behavior. So we need a holistic approach. And those large social determinants in our food system are what seem to be driving this more so than what people typically think about individual dietary behaviors. Okay, well, next up, I'd like to do a series of stories about women and their health, and particularly the structural reasons that cause disparity living in a patriarchal and sexist society. So first up, from Stat News, women spend 20% more per year on out-of-pocket health costs, says report. Women of all ages pay a total of $15.4 billion more than men in annual out-of-pocket medical expenses, according to a new report from Deloitte. In 2021, that meant that women paid about 20% more than men, only 2% of which can be accounted for by maternity care. The fact that the way benefits are currently designed puts a disproportionate cost on women above and beyond maternity was the thing that really surprised us, said Kalini Gebreyes, a physician who runs Deloitte's healthcare practice and also serves as the company's U.S. Chief Health Equity Officer. The pink tax, in which products marketed to women cost more than similar products aimed at men, is a familiar phenomenon to many. But that typically applies to items like pink razors and floral soaps, not annual checkups and cancer screenings. The Affordable Care Act also dictates that insurers charge men and women the same premium cost. But the new analysis found that despite seeking more healthcare treatments than men, women have lower actuarial values, meaning that insurance covers less of their health claims than it does for men. Men are twice as likely as women to wait more than 2 years between visits to a healthcare professional, according to the report. Yet when they do go, they need fewer services. The report identified a few reasons why women may utilize healthcare more than men, including recommendations for annual checkups at earlier ages, the regular frequency of gynecological exams, the effects of menopausal transitions, and more. But it was hard to pin down a reason for the huge gap in actuarial values. One potential cause could be that while insurers cover basic preventative care that people receive, they may not cover the expensive follow-up services. For example, if a woman receives a standard mammogram, insurance would cover that. But if they need a follow-up imaging for an abnormal result, the copay charges begin to stack up. Another possible explanation could be that women may have much worse insurance plans with higher deductibles or copays, which is what Cohen suspects. The difference could be attributed to gender disparities in the types of industries that women and men work in, or because women are more likely to be part-time workers. What we're really challenging is, when you're designing benefits, the difference between equality, paying the same premium, and equity, having health benefit coverage that meets your needs, Gebreyes says. So a good example of equality and equity are not the same thing. You can have the same premium, but it may not mean you're getting equitable care. You may have to pay more to get the same level of care. Okay, well, this next story dives in more deeply into one area of health, which is cancer. This from Stat News. Women faced a host of disadvantages in cancer prevention and care, report finds. Patriarchy isn't a word that Ophira Ginsberg expected to be at the center of her work as a cancer researcher, but like an infection, it was invading her everyday work as a medical oncologist. There were times when she saw people treat women's lives and health with cruel indifference. There were times when she saw women who struggled to access care because of violence or social obligations or stigma. There were the women missing from academic departments, funding committees, and medical leadership, and there was the missing knowledge of women's health and cancer. All of these things are part of what Ginsberg, a senior advisor at the National Cancer Institute Center for Global Health, calls the nexus of women, power, and cancer. Ginsberg and colleagues worldwide joined together to form a Lancet Commission on Women and Cancer to study this nexus a few years ago. The commission just published a lengthy, wide-ranging report dissecting many of the ways that gender inequality affects cancer care for women around the globe. The truth is, in many ways, in many places, women have very little choice to obtain care, even if care is available, even if poverty isn't the primary issue, because of power dynamics, Ginsberg said. Because of access to knowledge, who is the locus of decision-making in the family, and access on the financial domain as well, patriarchy dominates every aspect of these issues. The commission conducted original research, reviewed literature, and also published an epidemiological study estimating preventable and treatable cancer deaths worldwide. The report has 10 main findings, including that women are more likely to go bankrupt from cancer than men, and that 2.3 million deaths could be averted if all women had optimal cancer care, primary prevention, and early detection. On the whole, cancer is less preventable in women than in men. That's a very surprising statement for most of my colleagues, including me, she said. That's a very important finding, and it has to do with what we don't understand about merging risks for women. There are social determinants that impact a woman's opportunity to obtain care and stay on the care pathway. One of them is just how we speak with women. For an example, clinicians use language like neglected breast cancer, which places blame on the women. It's with the best of intentions, but this language can create a power differential when it places blame on the patient, like, why didn't you come in earlier? You have to listen to women to be able to help them. We have to question the language we use when asking them, why did you come in so late? It's asking, how can we as health providers support women better to complete the course of therapy? A lot of women will tell us, in many countries, including the U.S., it's not that I came in for care late, I couldn't come in sooner because who will look after my children? Or they are in an abusive relationship, which may sound out of left field, but it's unfortunately a common story with respect to a woman's ability to use whatever resources are in the household to seek care. In the quantitative data, we show in the report that for women of all ages, 1.3 million lives could be saved in just four major risks that are avoided: tobacco, alcohol, obesity, and infections. Let's just take infections for a second. If women can just get screened for cervical cancer and HPV, they won't get cervical cancer. But how can they access care if governments don't prioritize them, if companies are not brought to the table to lower prices for highly effective screenings that we have, and girls don't have the opportunity to receive the vaccine? This also comes back to power, not just on an individual choice level. We have to change things on a policy level. You mentioned earlier the findings that cancer is generally less preventable in women than men. Could you talk more about that? Even though men have a slightly higher risk of developing cancer, 48% of all cancers occur in women and 44% of cancer deaths occur in women, tobacco and alcohol are much bigger drivers of cancer risk and death among men than women. So, we have loads of policies and actions that can be taken on an individual or national level to prevent tobacco and alcohol-related cancer. Women are more likely to die of cancer specific to women than men are to die of cancer specific to men. More women-specific cancers out there. Breast cancer, for instance, has a lot of research and dollars now, but the lion's share is on treatment, which is incredibly important. But we still don't understand so much about the risk of breast cancer, despite it being so common. To quote the director of the International Agency for Research on Cancer, we are never going to treat ourselves out of the cancer epidemic. We have to invest more in prevention, looking at the causes, genetic epidemiology, and much more. We still don't understand how many emerging risks and products that are almost uniquely marketed towards women, based on patriarchal notions of beauty and racist notions of beauty, like hair relaxers. Why don't we know more about the potential long-term effects of these products? My goodness, there's so many personal products containing chemicals for which we know very little on the potential long-term effects. In the report, you talk about how patriarchy is part of this as well, what does or doesn't get researched, and how gender imbalance in oncology and medicine contributes to the problem. There are power dynamics at play with respect to what gets studied, who and what gets funded. You could say breast cancer has so much research attached to it, but there are less opportunities to study things uniquely affecting women compared to men. Globally, there has to be a lot more done. If women are in positions, if there are mechanisms in place to ensure that women have the same access as men as scientists to seek funding opportunities, then women are more likely to be interested in asking these types of questions. We, as a commission, are very hopeful that change is possible. Things are moving in a good direction, but not fast enough. A lot of women are oncologists, but very few are making it to the upper echelons. The top-ranked 100 cancer research journals, only 16% have a female editor-in-chief. We know that only 16 of 184 cancer research institutes and hospitals, part of the Union of International Cancer Control, are actually led by women. We can do a lot better. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Okay, well, let's continue our coverage of women's health. Let's drill down more specifically to black women and take a particular health issue among Black women, and that is fertility care. This from Axios. What will it take to eliminate disparities in fertility care for Black women? From better medical training to more inclusive health benefits, a host of new efforts are aimed at reversing long-standing disparities and stigma that have prevented Black women from seeking out fertility treatments. Why it matters? Black women may be twice as likely to have fertility challenges than white women, but cultural factors, underscored by new research, contribute to Black adults seeking treatments less and silently suffering more. According to a new Pew Research Center data report, about a quarter of Black adults said they or someone they know use fertility treatments, while nearly half of white adults surveyed the same. In the Black community, fertility treatment in general is considered something that, quote-unquote, only white women partake in, says Stephanie Thompson, a reproductive endocrinologist and infertility specialist. Being a Black woman myself and being a Black infertility specialist, this is something I've seen and known throughout my entire career, she says. Because Black adults with infertility don't tend to share their experiences, you think you're the only one, and there's this thought process that Black women don't suffer from infertility, even in our own community. I think the stigma is related to the historical perspective that Black women are not supposed to be infertile, and that goes back to slavery, when part of the purpose of Black women's slaves was breeding, Thompson says. Those cultural pressures and less familiarity with fertility options are some reasons why Black patients are typically older than white patients when they do seek out treatment. That hurts their chances at a live birth because fertility success is largely dependent on a woman's age. The earlier you are diagnosed and the problems are addressed, the better the outcomes will be, says Thompson. Of note, across racial and ethnic groups, causes of infertility are estimated to stem from male reproductive issues one-third of the time, female reproductive issues one-third of the time, and the rest from both or either unknown factors. A combination of health issues and systemic barriers may contribute to higher infertility rates among Black women. Black patients are less likely to seek out early healthcare treatment overall, including for potential fertility health concerns like uterine fibroids that affect Black women at disproportionately high rates, partly because of the community's historic distrust of the healthcare system that has mistreated people of color. Historic racism isn't only a deterrent from seeking care, but also a cause for needing it. Studies suggest that chronic exposure to systemic racism could lead to negative health outcomes, including infertility. Cost is another major barrier to accessing fertility treatment. The average cost of one in vitro fertilization cycle is between $10,000 and $15,000, according to the Society for Assisted Reproductive Technology. And that's before medications and additional cycles that could cost thousands more. Even patients who have health plans that cover in vitro fertilization can face huge bills. Relatively few state Medicaid programs cover fertility assistance, which has a disproportionate impact on women of color. Thompson says she is seeing some positive changes that could encourage more Black adults to seek out fertility services. For one, employees are offering more fertility benefits to help attract and retain employees. Also, medical school curriculums are now more focused on cultural competency and treating every aspect of a patient's life, something that Thompson says got little attention when she was a student. And news coverage and social media are doing a much better job of acknowledging and addressing the issue. Another welcome new development, Thompson says, is a growing number of support groups. Fertility clinics likely can provide information on support networks. There are many. But she says that sharing fertility experiences with good friends shouldn't be overlooked. You'll find that many probably know somebody or have gone through it, and they can serve as a support for you. Okay, well, next up, a move that could expand access to over-the-counter birth control and other over-the-counter products. This from The Hill. Biden administration looking to expand coverage of over-the-counter birth control and other products. The Biden administration is asking for public comment on whether to require most health insurance plans to cover a range of over-the-counter preventive products, including contraception, for free. The Affordable Care Act requires insurers to cover preventive services, including specific types of birth control, but only if they are prescribed. Insurers usually don't cover over-the-counter products. The Departments of Health and Human Services, Labor, and Treasury said they want comments on how such a policy would impact access to a range of over-the-counter items, including contraceptives, tobacco smoking cessation products, folic acid during pregnancy, and breastfeeding supplies. The comment request builds off a series of executive orders from the White House, including one from June aimed at increasing access to contraception and family planning. It also comes after the first over-the-counter birth control pill was approved by the FDA earlier this year. O-pill is likely to become available in stores and online starting in early 2024 for women of all ages. The push to make birth control available over-the-counter has been happening for years, but after the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade and ended the constitutional right to an abortion, the movement took on more urgency. The price of O-pill hasn't yet been disclosed, but studies have shown even a small cost burden can present a significant barrier and make a drug inaccessible. We know that making preventive care available over the counter can improve access, but there still are many cost barriers, said Health and Human Services Secretary Javier Becerra. In the announcement, the agency said they were focused on advancing health equity and hoped the comments would expand understanding in addressing systemic racism and historic inequity for women and LGBTQ communities. Okay, next up from Stat News, children of color and from low-income families disproportionately harmed by toxic chemicals. Children are often exposed to harmful chemicals in air, water, soil, food, food packaging, and plastics. However, low-income children and children of color are disproportionately impacted by these exposures, according to the authors of a study that examines disparities in neurotoxic exposures and their harmful effects on children by race, ethnicity, and economic status. The review, published in Environmental Health Perspectives, highlights racial disparities in toxic chemical exposures and neurodevelopmental outcomes in children. The researchers analyzed 218 epidemiological studies conducted over nearly 15 years that examined exposures to air pollution, lead, mercury, organophosphate pesticides, phthalates, polybrominated diphenyl ethers, and polychlorinated biphenyls, PCBs. As a result of discriminatory practices and policies, low-income children and children of color are currently and historically disproportionately exposed to chemicals without their knowledge or consent, where they live, work, play, pray, and learn, said Devin Payne Sturgis, an associate professor at the University of Maryland School of Public Health. Their neighborhoods are more likely to be located near factories, chemical plants, Superfund sites, highways and more vehicle traffic, or by agricultural fields where pesticides are applied. Policy changes are needed at the federal level, the study authors said. FDA and EPA can act now, not later, to safeguard families from neurotoxic chemicals by banning phthalates from food contact materials, eliminating lead from residential environments, aviation gas, and children's food, ending the use of organophosphate pesticides, and setting air pollution standards to protect children's brain development. So a large plate of opportunities to protect children, particularly those poor and children of color who are disproportionately impacted by those exposures. Okay, well, let's get to a little bit better news for kids. This from Axios. Millions more students eligible for free school meals. Millions of more students will gain access to free breakfast and lunch at school, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced. The expansion of the community eligibility provision will make some 3,000 additional school districts serving more than 5 million students eligible for meals at no cost. Schools where 25% of families receive income-based federal assistance programs like SNAP, Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, will qualify. The previous qualifying threshold was 40%. Increasing access to free, healthy school breakfast and lunch will decrease childhood hunger, improve child health, and student readiness, and put our nation on the path to better nutrition and wellness, Agricultural Secretary Tom Vilsack said. Meanwhile, eight states, California, Colorado, Maine, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, New Mexico, and Vermont, have all passed laws to make meals free for all students. And a little bit of a flashback, in case you forgot, in response to the COVID-19 pandemic, the federal government expanded a program in March of 2020 that covered the cost of breakfast and lunch for low-income students to include all pupils. So that period during the pandemic, all students, now we're trying to fight back and achieve that once again. That has been shown over and over again to be a very effective, both in its outcomes and from a cost perspective. Those pandemic things expired in June of 22, so it's been over a year trying to bring them back. Okay, well, last up in my regular reporting, I wanted to report on something from one of my favorite websites, Mad in America, which deals with a lot of alternative, so-called alternative approaches to mental health. And this is Report on Improving Mental Health Outcomes. And I'll read, there's a very long study report, but I'll read a little bit from the executive summary. The mental health system's standard treatments are colossally counterproductive and harmful, often forced on unwilling patients. The over-reliance on psychiatric drugs is reducing the recovery rate of people diagnosed with serious mental illness from a possible 80% to 5%, and reducing their lifespans by 20 years or so. Psychiatric incarceration, euphemistically called involuntary commitment, is similarly counterproductive and harmful, adding to patients' trauma, and is massively associated with suicide. Harmful psychiatric interventions are being imposed on people without consideration of the facts about treatment and their harms, and are a violation of international law. The most important elements for improving patients' lives are people, place, and purpose. People, even psychiatric patients, need to have relationships, that is people, a safe place to live, that is place, and activity that is meaningful to them, usually school or work, that is purpose. People need to be given hope these are possible. Voluntary approaches that improve people's lives should be made broadly available instead of the currently prevailing counterproductive and harmful psychiatric drugs for everyone, forever regime often forced on people. By implementing these approaches, mental health systems can move towards and even achieve the 80% possible recovery rate. As bad as it is for adults, the psychiatric incarceration and psychiatric drugging of children and youth is even more tragic and should cease. Instead, children and youth should be helped to manage their emotions and become successful, and their parents should be given support and assistance to achieve this. So this is something I reported on a lot about. A lot of this is just basic needs and the ability to make human connections and having purpose, you know, school or work, a vocation of some sort in life. When you deprive people of that, it exacerbates mental health problems, not treats them. Okay, well, that brings us to the segment of the show called Bonus Articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give you the link again at the end of the list. Okay, a record-setting 35 bonus articles this week, so let's get to it. And I can guarantee you that there's a high probability that you may learn more in the next 10 minutes or so than any other 10 minutes this week, so let's get to it. Bonus article 1, clouds now contain plastic, risking contamination of, quote, everything we eat and drink. So we find plastic just about where else in the world, but it's literally raining down on us. Good article. Bonus article 2, PFAS forever chemicals harming wildlife the world over. So we share the world with a lot of other living beings, and these PFAS forever chemicals are harming them in many ways worldwide. Bonus article 3, decades later, closed military bases remain a toxic menace. So you've had bases that have been closed for decades and may never be reopened or reused and awaiting cleanup. So that's another one of those long-term things. You know, we look at the value of, for instance, say a military base, whatever that is over its lifespan, but it has a toxic legacy. And speaking of toxic legacies, here's bonus article 4. The Fire Department of New York deaths from 9/11 related illnesses now equal the number killed on September 11th. So obviously when you have something as palpably tragic as the terrorist attacks on September 11th that killed thousands of people, we have to remember that that reverberates, the health effects of that reverberate and now have actually exceeded the actual number of deaths that happened on September 11th. That's just from the fire department of New York, mostly to exposure to toxic chemicals in the rescue and cleanup process that took months and years. Bonus article 5, monster fracks are getting far bigger and far thirstier, threatening America's fragile aquifers. I reported on this in recent weeks. about how much water we're pulling out of our water aquifers. The water table is going down and creating all kinds of problems. We're just spending our future once again, and fracking is adding to it because it takes a lot of water and it's just getting bigger. Bonus Article 6, Louisiana's struggle with influx of salt water prompts a request for Biden to declare an emergency. So because of climate change and drought, the Mississippi is low, and when it gets really low, salt water from the sea backs up into it. And this is actually imbued all of the area around New Orleans, and that means that their city water supply is getting salt water in it, which is not healthy. And in a related story, bonus article 7, lead contamination could rise as salt water enters New Orleans area water systems and corrodes pipes. So salt can break up and corrode pipes and release lead in lead pipes. And that not only releases it for when the salt water is there, but could release it for years to come. Bonus article 8, we can't drink oil, how a 70-year-old pipeline imperils the Great Lakes. So the 70-year-old pipeline, that's hundreds of miles long, that runs under the Mackinac Strait, goes miles under the water. And they're actually talking about trying to revamp it to get another 100 years of use out of it. But if this thing breaks, and it's already the full length of those hundreds of miles, has released a million gallons of oil and gasoline over the years. But if it breaks in the Great Lakes, that'll be a tragedy on the order of the one in the Gulf Coast oil spill. Okay. Bonus article 9. Mosquitoes are a growing public health threat, reversing years of progress. So this is something I've reported on a bit before, and it's also climate change driven, that we're getting mosquitoes in more areas, and there's some other things that are tamping back our progress on malaria, for instance, which bonus article 10 is about. Mainstay malaria drug may be beginning to fail in the Horn of Africa. This drug failure has been happening in Asia, but now it's happening in Africa, where 95%+ of malaria deaths occur. Bonus article 11. Studies suggest poor environmental controls and poor sanitation may aid spread of resistant pathogens to humans. So this is many areas in the world where you have poor sanitation and you're also living close to animals. You get resistant pathogens that may develop in animals, but that are more easily transmitted to humans. Not good. Bonus article 12, FDA releases draft guidance on antibiotic duration limits in food animals. So here in the U.S., we've been trying to tamp down the amount of antibiotics we're using in food animals because that also drives antibiotic resistance, and the FDA is trying to tighten those up. Bonus article 13, nitazenes, synthetic opioids more deadly than fentanyl, are starting to turn up in overdose cases. So the continually involving fentanyl, synthetic opioid overdose epidemic, these new nitazenes, unfortunately, when somebody's exposed to these, one dose of Narcan won't do it. You probably need at least two, making it much more difficult to reverse and save people's lives with overdoses. And next up, bonus article 14, an interesting connection between climate change and drug and alcohol disorders. Elevated temperatures and climate change may contribute to rising hospitalizations from drug and alcohol disorders. I reported earlier how when you get high temperatures, particularly methamphetamines, can raise your body temperature and make you at higher risk for high temperatures. But this actually may be driven just by expanding warm months where people are outside, and people that are on drugs and inebriated tend to do more crazy things, so you get more exposure with that. Bonus article 15, a decades-long drop in teen births is slowing, and advocates worry a reversal is coming. This is linked up with the attacks on Roe v. Wade and the whole abortion battles, in that that also includes trying to fend off a lot of attacks on birth control, making family planning more difficult. Bonus article 16, abortion restrictions repel graduating OB-GYNs from conservative states. So I've reported on this before, but this is a new study that basically said 1 in 7 of new OB-GYNs changed their plans from their placement or where they were going to go to practice. And it was 8 times more likely that they went from a conservative abortion-restricting state to a pro-choice state than the other way around. So this is bad news for red states who already have higher rates of pregnancy and abortion-related problems. So it's just going to exacerbate that. Okay, let's do a couple stories here on racial inequities. Bonus Article 17. Prostate cancer, a notable killer of black men, can be made less deadly by modifying key risks. And these are a lot of things from healthcare to even social determinants, socioeconomic status, that type of thing. The thing I find kind of interesting and a little depressing about this is that because black men have had a much higher rate, there's this lingering notion that has to do with black men are physiologically different, like they're some different kind of race. And of course, this is a racist belief that has persisted for centuries. But this is just yet another study that says that's not the case. These are socially determined inequities. It's not something intrinsic to black men. It has to do with a dysfunctioning social environment. Bonus Article 18, black people are more likely to be physically restrained in emergency rooms. If that wasn't true, I would be surprised, unfortunately. Bonus Article 19, an understaffed and broken system. 900,000 Texans have lost Medicaid as others struggle to access SNAP benefits. So the Texas system is overwhelmed, and it's the same system that deals with Medicaid and SNAP. So when Medicaid's overwhelmed, it affects SNAP as well. And Texas, unfortunately, is a good or a terrible example, depending how you look at it, on this Medicaid unwinding after the pandemic. And the next story gets at why that's particularly bad. Article 20, Medicaid rolls are being cut. Few are finding refuge in ACA plans, the Obamacare plans. Probably less than 10% of people that are kicked off the Medicaid rolls are actually moving to an Obamacare plan on the healthcare exchanges. Not good. They're becoming uninsured. Bonus Article 21. As COVID infections rise in nursing homes, many are still waiting for vaccines. So this is a change. The bonus Article 22 is actually vaccine rollout is a mess today, but it wasn't during the pandemic. So there was a lot of effort and resources and coordination put into making sure that rolling out the COVID vaccines originally was done well. And actually, it's a really kind of an epic job that we kind of maybe don't really appreciate it. But now we're back to kind of the regular American healthcare mess where it's all fragmented. Okay, another COVID story. Bonus Article 23, free rapid COVID tests are back. How should we use them? So if you're still wondering about what's the best way to use a COVID test, and if you want to get one of those COVID tests, you can get 4 free tests by going to covidtests.gov, covidtests.gov. Bonus Article 24, peak COVID viral loads at 4th and 5th day of symptoms onset may influence best home test timing. So as we've gotten more immunity through vaccines and infections and the change in the variants, we're seeing that actually the peak viral loads went from earlier in the course to actually later. So because the home tests are much better when the viral loads are high, testing early in a potential infection is probably less likely to identify, which makes things a little bit tricky. So one thing to consider. Article 25, did the government get a bad deal on the COVID-19 boosters? So it depends how you answer the questions. They're paying a lot more for each COVID test, but because they're not like the primary, almost sole buyer of COVID vaccines in the U.S., they're buying them through, quote, regular channels, which is these smaller purchases, which end up costing a lot more. So I would say mostly yes, they're getting a bad deal. The fact that they're paying multiples more than they were before. Bonus Article 26. Biden administration draws commitment from health insurers to cover COVID-19 shots. Now, they're supposed to cover COVID-19 shots, but they haven't, and that's partly because of our fragmented system. It's a little bit of enforcement, got the insurers to agree to tighten that up. But that just goes to show you, when you don't have a highly coordinated system, there are a lot of cracks that were created. And speaking of that, bonus article 27, U.S. to rein in algorithms that limit Medicare Advantage plans. So these privatized Medicare Advantage plans are using algorithms that are doing a lot of crazy limiting of care for people, where the clinicians are like, I don't think that's a good idea. You're not actually looking at the person's actual circumstances. You just have some algorithm that's kicking out some denial of service. So they're trying to rein that in. Bonus article 28. Two large medical groups shun Medicare Advantage plans completely. So this is kind of a new thing on the front. Medicare Advantage plans are now the majority of Medicare. And these privatized plans have a lot of problems that I've reported a lot on before. And that's problems both from the people who have Medicare Advantage, but also the providers. And to have large medical groups just refuse to even accept Medicare Advantage is kind of an inflection point. We'll have to see where that goes in the future. Bonus article 29, disability groups win fight to be included in health equity research at NIH. This is long overdue. I'm kind of surprised that wasn't the case. But hopefully in the future, we'll learn more about equity issues with disability groups. Bonus article 30, exodus of life scientists from academia reaches historic levels. So the basically people doing biomedical research largely through the NIH are actually, most of them are more so than before, a record number of level of people, researchers, life scientists are going to the private sector. Bonus article 31, kids and teens are inundated with phone prompts day and night. This is a good study if you want to get into the details of that. Bonus article 32, to prevent gun violence, these peacemakers start with the basics. This is an interesting one about going back to social determinants. Giving people food and making connections and building trust can actually help prevent gun violence. 33, what's a food forest? Metro Denver already has 19 of them. We have one over here in the Collingwood Garden, a few blocks from my house, but Denver is really rocking it. Bonus article 34, forget about living to 100, let's live healthier instead. An interesting opinion piece just talking about putting more health into our lives rather than just simply expanding lifespan. And while our lifespan is going down, our healthy years is suffering as well. And lastly but not least, 35, study pinpoints the length of incidental activity linked to health benefits, basically about exercise. And I've reported a lot on this. And basically, moving is good, and particularly even short bursts of more strenuous exercise is particularly beneficial. You can view these and all the stories I've reported on in this and all the other shows I've ever done by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some